raindrops are falling on my head.
People from Alabama through North Georgia would love to see raindrops, a lot of them, because that part of the country has been suffering through a severe drought. Dry weather is the topic of this week's edition of Jet Streaming.
So I just did me some talking to the sun, and I said I did.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Kathy Werzer, the host of the Minnesota Public Radio podcast devoted to the weather and climatology, cleverly named Jet Streaming. With us, Mark Seeley from the University of Minnesota and Paul Huttner, Minnesota Public Radio meteorologist. How are you guys?
Doing just fine as we approach the summer solstice here.
How are you doing, Paul?
Great, Kathy. My favorite time of the year as well. I love it.
We're going to talk about that later on. Well, we're going to begin, though, by talking about some serious flooding in Texas this week. Rainfall of an inch every 15 minutes. Can you imagine that?
My word.
And in the meantime, there are areas of the southeast and some western states where folks are praying for rain. How bad is it? We've called on Brad Rippey. He's a meteorologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Hello, Brad. How are you?
Good day. How are you doing?
So far, so good. Thank you. Where are the driest areas of the country right now, Brad?
The very driest area right now is centered on northern Alabama. Those areas are experiencing at least a 1-in-50-year drought, in some cases the worst since records began back in 1895. Looking at the spring numbers, March, April, May, it was the driest spring on record in four southeastern states, including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee. So this is truly a historic drought for the southeast.
And how long has this gone on now in terms of years?
Well, for parts of northern Alabama, really at the center of this drought, we've seen the deficits piling up over the last 2.5 years. We have a few stations in northern Alabama that have seen 50-inch rainfall deficits over since the beginning of 2005. And that is about a year's worth of rain in 2.5 years. So that's a very, very substantial deficit for these folks.
Brad, Mark Seeley here. I wanted to ask you, regarding this particular area of the country, the U.S. seasonal drought outlook, at least through August, has favored portions of the southeast seeing some improvement in the situation down there. And I wanted to ask if that was directly tied to the forecast for expected more active tropical storm season in that particular region?
Yes, I think the direct answer to that is yes. The fact that we're expecting above normal tropical activity in the Atlantic Basin, of course, that would favor the Atlantic coast states and the immediate Gulf Coast for significant drought relief. There's a little bit more of a question about the interior as you head into Tennessee, Alabama, northern Mississippi, Kentucky, whether we'll get enough tropical moisture into those areas to completely, I don't think we'll eradicate the drought, but, you know, I think we're still looking at a very serious long-term situation for the interior southeast.
Following up on that briefly, of course, the tropical storm can deliver abundant precipitation in very short order, but it sounds like in the historical context, you're framing the situation there in a way that makes me think this is going to take rather long-term recovery, looking at months or years to bring all the hydrologic systems back up to near normal levels.
Right. If you're looking at a 50-inch deficit like we have in Huntsville and some other stations in northern Alabama, it's going to take more than a 4-to-8-inch tropical storm to eradicate those long-term deficits. So we probably will have to wait. We'll hope for a good tropical season. What we want to see is a number of weak tropical storms. Obviously, we don't want a Katrina or an Ivan hitting the Gulf Coast. We'd like to see a number of weak tropical systems hitting the southeast this summer, later this summer, this fall, and then go into a good recharge season, a lot of active storms in the southeast this winter. But it's going to take a long, long time for full recovery in the southeast.
Brad, Paul Huttner here. Good day to you. The big picture, the southeast, we have the drought. Here up in the upper Midwest, Lake Superior is at its lowest level in 81 years. It's down some 20 inches below average. And in the southwest, of course, extreme drought as well. Lake Mead, Lake Powell, running around 50% of their capacity. Lake Okeechobee, we know, record low levels. You look at the big picture. We're seeing drought over a lot of the country as you look at the drought monitor map today. What is your assessment of that, and how does that compare to the geographic area where we normally, if you will, might see drought in the United States?
Well, my take on the whole drought situation is that for the last several months, we have seen very poorly distributed rainfall patterns. That is to say, almost all the heavy rain has fallen out across the middle third of the country in the last couple of months. At the same time, we've totally bypassed California, Arizona, the southern Great Basin all last winter. And, of course, we just talked about the southeastern situation. And then you mentioned the kind of the third, the forgotten area, the upper Great Lakes region, with the very serious drought in parts of the UP of Michigan and stretching into Minnesota and northern Wisconsin.
You know, here, this might seem like a simplistic question, gentlemen, but help me out here. And Brad, you can chime in first. Can a drought deepen because of continued dry conditions? Is it almost a vicious cycle?
Yes. What happens is patterns become established, and just the simple fact that there's not moisture in the soil can create a feedback cycle that can lead to more drought. If you don't have soil moisture in place, there's nothing for the storms to tap into. I mean, obviously, you've got the oceans, but as you get into the interior of the country, that can be a vicious feedback cycle.
Brad, I can't help but ask this. I know you've been at your type of work for quite a few years, and I'm wondering what your opinion is regarding the climate research community and the thought that climate change will bring more frequent drought to parts of the contiguous U.S. What do you feel about that?
I think we have gone into more extreme weather in recent years. I don't know as though there's been a consensus reached on the reasons for that, but we certainly seem to be, like I mentioned, with the poorly distributed rainfall pattern so far this year, we seem to be seeing a lot of extremes, I mean, not just in precipitation patterns, but temperature patterns as well. You can look to the warm March we had across much of the country, followed by that historic early April freeze. And just in all arenas of the climate regime, not just in the United States, but globally, we do seem to be seeing a lot of very extreme weather events.
It seems like we have built a capacity in this country that relies on receiving normal precipitation or abundant precipitation, a very heavy dependence in terms of our hydrologic features as well as our agricultural production systems, so that sharp negative deviations have rather dire consequences for these.
Really, the only part of the country, I think, that has somewhat adapted to this type of cycle is the western United States, where water is managed in many cases on a multi-year level. You mentioned the big lakes on the Colorado, Lake Mead and Lake Powell. They are multi-year systems, so they are designed to withstand at least a few years of drought. But if you look back in some of the tree ring records, some of these southwestern areas have experienced decades of drought centuries ago. That could happen again. We may be heading into a pattern where we're seeing decadal patterns of drought for the western United States. And that is, with the population increase, that could have some dire consequences.
Brad, that dovetails perfectly into what I was thinking, having spent some time in the Southwest in Arizona, watching how some of the water managers, the governors, are putting together plans to try to deal with what is really their lifeblood, the Colorado River water in the Southwest. Now, some of the PACs for distributing that water were drawn up back in the 1920s when some of the stream flow for the Colorado was at its highest level in a century. They didn't know that at the time, but now we're seeing reduced snowpack in the West in the winter up in Colorado and Utah, of course, and that is where that water comes from. What are the effects here as you see it down the road? What are the practical realities of less water in places like the Southwest because of those low flows on the Colorado?
I'll answer that in a couple of parts here. First, the short-term outlook for the western United States is actually pretty dire. We had a below-normal snowpack season for a large part of the West. Only the Northwest, Northern Rockies, and some of the eastern slopes of the Rockies did pretty well last winter. So you've got a big chunk of the West. You can look at the drought monitor map. You see that drought encompasses a big area of the West. Then we had the warm March. We had a warm May. The snowpacks melted off very early. So for this summer alone, we're facing some very serious consequences in the West. I was crunching some numbers for California alone. They have a 151 reservoir system, and typically there's still recharge all the way to the end of May and into early June. Well, in May alone, California lost about three-quarters of a trillion gallons of water at a time when they should be gaining about half a trillion gallons. So you see we're going the wrong way on the curve. We should have still been melting off snow, recharging the reservoirs, and instead we're draining them in May instead of later in the summer like we would expect. That's just an example of what the West is going to face this summer, especially in the California, the Great Basin, the southwestern states. And from a longer perspective, it's going to be a continuing issue. I mean, people talk about water being the liquid gold or the liquid oil of the 21st century, and that is certainly true. Frankly, I don't know where we're going to get all of our water in the West. We have so many competing interests, including agricultural use, environmental for endangered species, for industrial, municipal use, of course, and then recreational use as well. You can't put your boat in the water if your dock's half a mile from the lake. So it is going to be a hot-button issue for years to come with the increasing population and the fact that we've been in a on-and-off drought in the West for about a decade now.
You know, Brad, you're with the USDA, so I need to ask you about the effects of all this on agriculture from where you stand.
What we're seeing in recent years of the drought in the West is that some of the smaller reservoirs and basins have to cut off irrigation supplies early. So that has an implication for people like small grain producers in the Northwest, where they get their water cut off early. They have to decide whether it's worth it to keep that crop going to try to get by on what rain falls or just to tear it up and claim disaster relief. It's a tough situation. We're not seeing that in the big basins yet, the big reservoirs, but that's a year-to-year issue in some of the smaller areas.
Boy, I tell you, it rips your heart out to hear some of the farmers in Alabama and that area of the southeast where they're watching their crops shrivel to nothing.
Yeah, we've got a very bad situation going for the southeastern rain-fed crops right now. Just looking at a couple of the condition numbers for Alabama, it just shows you how bad things really are. Cotton is running 80% very poor to poor on the latest crop report that came out on June 17th.
Well, Brad, I appreciate your time here this morning. It was very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Brad Rippey. He's with the USDA. He's a meteorologist with the United States Department of Agriculture.
It comes the summertime. Yeah, it's coming soon. I remember living upstairs, drinking iced tea and swimming pools.
If I had to pick my favorite season, it would have to be summer. I love the heat, the humidity, the storms, everything relating to summer except the bugs. That's another story.
I'm with you on that one.
Now, Paul, you said that summer's your favorite time, huh?
It is. You know what? I'm a sunset guy. So I love these late sunsets that we get here in Minnesota in the Twin Cities. Our latest sunset here, 9:03 p.m., but the angle of the sun as it sets this time of year is such that the sky remains light until almost 10 o'clock if you have any kind of a view to the west, and that sun sets from 9 o'clock or later here from June 13th right to July 10th. So this is kind of the golden month here for us sunset lovers in the upper Midwest.
The summer solstice, Mark mentioned this early on, begins at 1:06 p.m. Central Time, Thursday, June 21st. As weather geeks, do you guys mark the change in season in any way, Paul?
You know, I get to the beach, my favorite secret beach, and I watch that late sunset every night because it has a great view to the northwest. And in the summer, that sun drops right in the west northwestern sky. It's a beautiful thing.
My favorite secret beach. Wow, we'll ask you about that later on.
Sounds mysterious.
I'll never tell.
Mark, do you do anything?
I take advantage of the evenings. In fact, I think I spend most of my outdoor time this time of year, Kathy, in the evening hours. That's when I like to be outside rather than midday.
Well, there are celebrations, as you all know, planned around the world to mark the longest day of the year. One of them occurs in the upper Midwest. It's the Solstice River. It is an annual dance performance on the Stone Arch Bridge in Minneapolis. And joining us right now to talk about that is Mary Lee Hardenberg. She's the producer and choreographer of Solstice River. Mary Lee, thank you.
Hi.
Tell us about this show.
Okay, well, first of all, I just want to say that I'm an artist in residence at the Center for Global Environmental Education. And as part of my job as artist in residence there, I create this artistic and educational program where people come down to the Stone Arch Bridge in downtown Minneapolis, and they watch as the whole river basin explodes with color and dancers. Dancers are on top of the silos on the Guthrie. They're down in the river in kayaks. And the music, then you hear the music broadcast over a radio performance. And we also hand out beautiful programs to all the people who come to the river, including a little explanation about what you guys all know about, the 23.5-degree angle or the constant tilt of the earth, and what the winter tilt looks like and the summer tilt looks like. So explaining solstice a little bit. And then we also want to educate people a little bit about the health of the Mississippi River and what everybody in the Twin Cities can do to help our Mississippi. But my art form is called site-specific dance. So I find a site, such as the Mississippi River, but then I need a time to put the dance on. And so for a performance, you have to choose a day. And so I like to mark the seasons. So this is, I've chosen in the past equinox days, or sometimes full moon rising, or there was one year where the full moon was rising on the fall equinox, which my understanding is it just happens every 29 years or so.
Yes.
So anyway, the I love to mark the passage of the seasons. As a dancer, rhythm is really important to me. And there is a rhythm, albeit very slow, that has a predictable count to it. You know, it goes winter, summer. So anyway, I love to listen to the slow rhythm, and every summer solstice to mark it with a performance, which offers people a sense of place, and it strengthens community. And I believe that beauty is really powerful. And the feedback we always get from it is it's so beautiful, with dancers just surrounding you. We have some on the St. Anthony Falls Hydrology Laboratory and the Lock and Dam. So there are these wonderful splotches of color that dance to the music.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great.
Mary Lee, this sounds like a wonderful artistic event to celebrate the solstice. I can't help but wonder, is this absolutely unique, or are there any other regions that perhaps do similar events to this?
You know, I have to plead ignorance on that one. I don't know of other performances on the summer solstice that are of this scale.
How has the weather factored into this? I know this has been going on for some years on the Stone Arch Bridge. Do you know, has the summer solstice delivered some kind weather for this kind of artistic event?
I have some sort of hair-raising stories, but I think the most amazing story was last year where I will say I must have had 100 performances in my career. Not a single one of them has been rained out. But last year, it was raining quite heavily until, and then it stopped raining 1 minute before the performance.
Perfect.
And the sun came out a little bit, and then precisely as the performance ended, boom, it began raining again. So, and then there have been other years where there have been a lot of tornadoes predicted, and then suddenly it was okay. If it's very, very windy, which it can be sometimes, it's a little hard on the dancers with their big fabric, pieces of fabric, but we have choreographed all the movements to be done in very high winds.
Ah, so at least there have been no instances of human kites or people taking off or something like that. That's good. I'm glad to hear it. Paul, do you have a question?
Yeah, Mary Lee, I'm curious. This sounds lovely. What kind of colors do you choose for a summer solstice, and what gave you this idea in the first place?
The colors we chose actually are trying to reflect things at the site. So the flags, which are these huge pieces of fabric at the very end, we're trying to pull out the colors of the sunset, which are red, orange, and yellow. Then there's also orange navigation balls on the Mississippi, so people don't go over the falls. Mm-hmm. And we choose the colors to reflect, like there's the gold medal silo color, which is yellow during the day and then red at night. And our dancers are wearing costumes that are red on one side and yellow on the other.
How fun.
Yeah.
See, this goes to show that we are expanding our focus, Mary Lee. We're of course, weather geeks here. So now the weather and the arts. See, this works out beautifully.
It does work out beautifully. So I would adore for people to come down to the Stone Arch Bridge Thursday at 8 o'clock. And it's free and open to the public. It's a wheelchair accessible and... it's just a wonderful family event.
Well, Mary Lee, you never know. We have listeners we now know all across the nation. So if they hear this idea, maybe they can go ahead and suggest to their own local arts groups to do something on the solstice next year. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Mary Lee Hardenberg. She's the producer and choreographer of Solstice River that'll celebrate the summer solstice this Saturday at 1:06 p.m. Central Time. Can you imagine Paul Huttner? I like the human kite, just the thought of these people.
I can, you know, I'm visualizing, because that's a beautiful area down there by the Stone Arch Bridge with the way the river comes through and the city on both sides. And I can imagine seeing all these people put in these wonderful places. I may have to get down there. That sounds really cool.
It does sound cool. Now, before we go, the website of the week.
Yes. You know, we talked a little bit about drought, and I thought this was kind of interesting. The biggest, baddest drought that we've all heard of course, the Dust Bowl days back in the 1930s. And I found this site called Wessels Living History Farm, and it's kind of a description of decades of farming in Nebraska, a place called York, Nebraska. And they've got some interesting highlights on this Dust Bowl and what it was like for them as families and generations to try to literally survive through the Dust Bowl, and they've got these awesome pictures of these huge walls of dust that some of us have seen that occurred in the 1930s. So that is livinghistoryfarm.org, all one word, livinghistoryfarm.org, and Wessels Living History Farm in Nebraska. Kind of a interesting look at farming during the Dust Bowl days.
Because I think people, unless you live through the Dust Bowl, of course, I mean, I think young folks just simply don't know how bad it was.
No, I really think we don't have a perspective on that. You know, I've seen some of these huge dust storms in Arizona, but nothing like this. And it was literally life or death for these folks back in the 30s.
Well, good one there, Paul. Thanks so much. Hey, Mark and Paul, we'll see you next week, okay?
All right, Kathy. I really must say, I love the infusion of artistic expression into jet streaming. I think we need to have more of this.
We'll reach beyond geekdom here.
It's a beautiful thing.
It is. It's a
beautiful
thing.
It's a beautiful thing.
Thank you. See you guys later.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thanks, Paul. That's going to do it for Jet Streaming, a podcast produced by Minnesota Public Radio. If you have a question for our experts or just a comment, heck, is there anyone listening out there? Drop us a line by going to the Jet Streaming podcast link at minnesotapublicradio.org. Thanks for listening in. This is Jet Streaming from minnesotapublicradio.org. I'm Kathy Werzer. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
Then tell me why. It feels like it might.